If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I mean, aside from just being in the market and finding great opportunities, which, you know, everyone's out there trying to do, I think the other wise thing is just understanding the market and not having unreasonable expectations, not really backed by anything, right?
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Rob Beardsley oversees acquisitions and capital markets for Lone Star Capital and has acquired over $100 million of multifamily real estate. He has evaluated thousands of opportunities using proprietary underwriting models and published the number one book on multifamily underwriting, The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on. Where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there? Can you give us just a brief overview?
Sure. So I grew up in Silicon Valley, California, in a real estate family. My parents ran a residential brokerage firm from home. So I got to hear all the deal making happen, and, you know, any sort of conversation could be quickly interrupted by a client call and have to, you know, get after it. So I grew up in that flow and in that world. Also saw my parents handle construction projects, development, fix and flips and things like that, but all on the single family side. So, and seeing them struggle and be so stressed out due to the transactional nature of their business, I wasn't particularly attracted to it. Maybe not at all, actually. You know, I was actually in Silicon Valley. So the thing that all the kids wanted to do was go into tech. And so I figured that would make sense. And so I went to school for computer science and ended up actually circling back to real estate as I was just on my journey of looking at investments, looking at wealth creation. And I just circled back to, you know, real estate, but not single family, and instead found multifamily, found it to be much more conducive towards long-term wealth creation, you know, building passive income and the like. So that really motivated me, because I'm always looking for the things I like in life are freedom. And I think there's great structure and free. I think there's great freedom in structure. So I like, you know, owning my time and being able to, you know, enjoy results for the long term. So that was what brought me to the multifamily space. And then from there, kind of drug my family into the business along with me, got them into multifamily investments. They started kind of shifting their capital allocation to multifamily as well as their focus, and ended up, you know, launching a company there. And then also I went out on my own, met my business partner, and we formed Lone Star to focus on owning and operating multifamily in Texas, which is my main job today.
Wow, that's really cool. So what was your first multifamily acquisition?
So the first one I would say is one where it was more so my family and I making a small investment as well as raising some capital. So we leveraged all the fabulous relationships that my parents essentially had built over their 30-year careers serving their clients. So we actually found, you know, we had great luck the first time around raising capital, raised all the money overnight. It was really exciting. We thought, wow, this thing might work. And so we took a back seat. We just, you know, partnered up. We didn't know much about the transaction side, the operation side. Basically, it started with myself underwriting the deal, doing some due diligence, you know, feeling comfortable with the opportunity. And then we invested and raised the money. And that was the first small deal that we participated in.
Gotcha. So that you guys, your lead sponsor on, but really took a backseat with all the other investors that came alongside of you. And then from there you said, hey, you know, we've proved out this model. We can just grow it from this point.
Yeah.
Is that about the sum of it?
Yeah. And then the goal obviously was to become, as you said, a lead sponsor where, you know, we're running the show, we're finding the deal, owning and operating it, and, you know, providing quality investor relations to our investors.
Right. What is the timeline on that journey from maybe that first deal until where you are today? How many years has that been?
So I want to say the time from the first deal that we participated in to then when we actually closed our first deal that we were the lead sponsor, I think that was about 6 months. Yeah. So it happened quick, and it happened maybe faster than maybe we were quite ready for. But the reason why is you just never know when a good deal is going to come, and you don't know what it's going to look like. And so, you know, we were just chasing deals as that's the nature of the business. And we just found one that thought made a lot of sense. It was a bit bigger than maybe what we were comfortable with, but we took the plunge and it worked out.
That's awesome. Have your folks ever come back to you and been like, gosh, why didn't we do multifamily sooner? Has that conversation ever happened?
Every single day.
Oh, geez. I mean, it's good for you, you know, for watching what your parents did and going, hey, I don't necessarily want to work. That model is not sustainable for you. And then pivoting and finding something, you know, that fit what who you are. So that's super cool. I think one of the things or one of the things I really want to spend the bulk of our time talking about today, though, is really your underwriting process. I know, again, you've written the book, The Definitive Guide to, what's the name of it again? The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions.
That's right.
So going back through some of the things that you've written about, conservative underwriting, things like that, what does that mean to you and how have you developed your criteria?
Yeah. So it all started with my interest in numbers, spreadsheets, formulas, puzzles, and things like that. So I really gravitated toward that part of the business. And also valuation is fascinating. And it's also critical. I mean, you can do everything right, but if you bought wrong or, you know, basically valued the property incorrectly, you could find yourself with a reality that's much different than your anticipated results.
Right.
So that was something, it's obviously very important. So I started just working at it, underwriting, you know, hundreds of deals. And that was the best way to really hone that. And through that period, I've also developed my own underwriting model, which is a great complement to the book that you mentioned is available for free on our website as well, which we can talk about at the end. But yeah, so the underwriting model, you know, started out very primitive. And then as my understanding grew, I was able to continue to modify and tailor my own spreadsheet so that it was really built for the way that we look at deals and kind of the metrics that we look for. And so as far as, you know, conservative underwriting and things like that, there's a few ways that you can, you know, there's many different ways that you can implement your spreadsheet and things like that. And so it's just kind of whenever there's a toss up and you could, well, I could do it this way, or I could do it that way. It's always taking the conservative angle, you know, so rather than, you know, having your sale value based on, you know, the forward year NOI, we just do it on the trailing 12 months. And, you know, there's just small things like that, but when added up can make a big difference in your projected numbers.
Right, right. Yeah. When you say the forward year NOI, you're saying like, let's say you're going to sell it in year five, you're using year four as the T12. You're saying you're using year four numbers in order to project what you're going to sell it for in year five?
No. So you see, I'm glad that we're on the same page because logic would have it that you would use a year five T12 NOI, but a lot of people you see will actually go to year six and grab 3% growth on that. And then that's their sale value. And they're kind of just boosting it a little bit. And see, that's not front and center. That's not something that you can just see in front of you in the spreadsheet, right? You'd actually have to dig into the guts of it. And so that's why I always recommend people to, for consistency, always use the same spreadsheet that they're using to analyze deals and not just accept someone else's model at face value.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would assume, I mean, how do you, yeah, I guess I did. All right. So there's one thing I wasn't even aware of. Like if I were underwriting a deal, I would say that we use year five because that's the year we're selling it. That's really interesting. How, I mean, did you just go out and underwrite hundreds of deals for fun? I mean, you said you underwrote hundreds of deals developing this. I mean,
no, I mean, it definitely wasn't for fun. It was, we were seriously out there looking for acquisitions and, you know, looking at hundreds of deals is what it takes to find good ones. And over the course of the deal, you know, some of the best learning experiences is taking your interpretation of the numbers and pitching the deal to either a lender or an investor or getting feedback from a management company. And just, you know, at the same time as you're building relationships, you can really learn a ton. And that's one of the ways that I really benefited and was able to learn very quickly.
Right, right. One of the things you talk about is using unlevered, placing an importance on unlevered IRR figures. How does that help you as you compare properties? I mean, because obviously one of the benefits of real estate is the fact that we can leverage it. So how do you make a deal make sense or not make sense by using that metric?
Yeah, so, you know, removing leverage out of the picture is one way to kind of simplify the numbers and to compare apples to apples. Because if we look at two deals and one deal has 60% leverage and the other deal has 80% leverage, the 80% leverage deal likely has a higher return, but is that the better deal? You know, maybe there are some risk factors to the 80% levered deal that actually make that return actually unattractive when compared against those risks. And so when you remove, like you said, at the end of the day, a huge, huge component of investing in real estate is the leverage you can get from debt. So it's not to minimize that or to say that, well, debt is bad. No, debt's wonderful. But it, when you take it back, you kind of get a more fundamental sense of the potential of the investment. And going peeling a layer even back further, instead of unlevered IRR, really our favorite metric is yield on cost. And so I'll explain the difference really is just between the fact that unlevered IRR factors in your sale, your future sale into the returns, whereas a yield on cost is a simply a measure. It's kind of like your future cap rate. So when you implement your business plan and you've maxed out the NOI, then you divide that by purchase price plus your CapEx, because that's the purchase price and the cost to get to that new high NOI. And now you've got kind of like a more smart cap rate of your completed business plan. And that's an untrended yield on cost, because we're not even trending the numbers over time for growth, even though that's we're investing in strong growth markets where we're anticipating rents to continue to outpace inflation and our expenses. But with an untrended yield on cost, that's our favorite metric. It's the most difficult to manipulate. It's just the truest sense of what the deal can do.
Right. And let's see if I can, if I'm hearing you correctly. Basically, you're saying take what this cost you and what it's making you once your business plan is implemented. All of the things out of the picture, what's the return on this?
Yeah, that's right. And it's the cure for the people that say, oh, cap rates don't matter, you know, because I'm going to value add, I'm going to raise rents. And what, well, it does. We can't unhinge ourselves to basis and valuation, right? So if you buy at a 3 cap, you better have a business plan that's going to take that 3 cap to a 6% yield on cost or something like that, depending on where the market is. And so, yes, it's true. It is not extremely relevant where you start, right? You can in fact buy a 2 cap. You know, we bought a Class C property that was a 2 cap because it was half vacant, right? But our yield on cost is 9% plus. So the risk justified the reward, or the reward justified the risk rather. And you know, similarly, we can buy a deal that let's say has a going in cap rate of 4.5, and maybe we don't need quite the same business plan and the same return on cost. We're happy with a 6% or even 5.5% yield on cost because it might be a better location and whatnot. So it is a really kind of objective way to look at things.
Right, right. Man, that's fantastic. How are you underwriting taxes into your deals conservatively? Like, what do you do to make sure that you are not going to get hosed? Let's talk taxes, and let's also talk insurance, because those are two things that we're seeing just some crazy spikes in.
Very frustrating and very important. And for the properties we look at in Texas, those are your two largest expenses often.
Sure.
Aside from payroll. And so for taxes, it varies by county and by state, of course. But in Texas, Texas is largely an income-driven tax assessor. So they're not as much concerned about what price you buy and sell at. They're really looking at the income of the property to determine the assessed value. So they use something called a loaded cap rate, which is basically they back out the property taxes out of the NOI, and then they add into your cap rate that they value the property, they add in the tax rate. So it's kind of hard to visualize or understand, but basically through that loaded cap rate, they're able to come up with what the property should be valued at on a tax basis. And then when they layer in that tax amount, they're getting to the cap rate that they want to value at. So that basically they say, okay, for this type of property in this area, we think it's a fair to say that it's a 5.5 cap. So then they'll try to apply tax amount that will solve for that 5.5 cap. And there's always a negotiation. We litigate the county for all of our properties every single year to negotiate down the tax rate or the taxable value. So as far as underwriting it, we are pretty aggressive because we don't want to, like you said, get smoked on taxes. It just looks bad. It can really affect the deal. So we're trying to bump up the taxes as, you know, judiciously as possible. And the other thing too is there's two things to look at. There's the going in tax rate, because there can, even though they're not sales chasing, they can in fact, you know, jump them quite a bit on sales. It is what it is. But then there's also the growth rate. And so I think the nuance that I want to share is, at least for an income driven tax assessor that we deal with most of the time, if you have a value add plan where you're going to raise income substantially through your renovations and rent increases, you better be factoring in an increase in your taxes every year as well, right? Because if you're raising income, you need to raise taxes. So we, in our model, we kind of have a pre-built formula that tracks the revenue growth and then adds and then accounts for tax increases similarly.
Yeah. So that's fascinating. So when it comes to insurance, I mean, that's something that, especially in the multifamily sector, we've just seen rapid and I'm going to call it uncontrolled rise in prices, even for properties that aren't suffering from losses. I mean, it just rises across the board. So how have you guys weathered that, and what are you doing to protect yourselves in that space?
So, you know, particularly in Houston, right, there's certain areas that have flood risk and more uncertainty. And so you need to be, you know, do your homework and be more prepared for that and understand what, you know, there's just a little more nuance to understand. But basically right off the bat, we're pretty much increasing insurance by 10 to 15% in our underwriting off of the trailing 12. And, you know, the existing insurance, we're bumping that 10 to 15% just as a starting point. And then we're always relying, of course, on our insurance broker to, you know, give us a firm indication that we can actually use before we make any, you know, hard commitment of any kind. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's just as simple as that, right? You have to take the numbers as they are and factor them in. But yeah, insurance has gone up crazy. And my hope is that it stabilizes at some point. And I mean, I don't know if it'll ever go down, but at least if it can just stop going up and just be more predictable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So taking all this into account, how are you guys finding deals in today's environment if you are really being a conservative underwriter? Like, cause I see stuff coming across my desk all the time that, I mean, just, it makes no sense at all. Like, I just throw it away. I go, what are you sending this to me? This is crazy. So how are you guys making it work?
Yeah. I mean, really it's kind of the same things we've always been doing, which is being very selective, looking at a lot of stuff. So, you know, in Q1, we underwrote over 100 deals, and you know, out of those 100, we have one under contract. So that's a perfect, you know, 100-to-1 ratio. I did a webinar recently going through that deal flow. We actually took out of that over 100 deals we underwrote, we took, I believe, 61 deals and actually put it into our deal analysis spreadsheet, where each row represents a deal that we fully underwrote. And we've got the NOI, we've got our CapEx budget, our purchase price that we bid, and then the price that the seller wanted. And so we've got all of that data there, and it informs us as to real deal numbers for our target acquisitions. Where are cap rates today? Where are return on costs, right? Because we know if the seller wants 20 million, we can look at our underwriting and say, well, at that price, they're essentially asking for us to pay a 5.25% return on cost, or that yield on cost metric I mentioned, right? Because again, cap rates are fuzzy, because if someone's selling us a deal that has, you know, $200 below market rents, saying that they're selling it to us for a 3 cap isn't as informative as saying, well, they're selling it to us at a 5.5% yield on cost, right? So we look at yield on cost. And so then, you know, really where we get, I mean, aside from, you know, just being in the market and finding great opportunities, which, you know, everyone's out there trying to do, I think the other wise thing is just understanding the market and not having unreasonable expectations, not really backed by anything, right? It's not realistic to be an absolute investor to sit here and say, well, I'm going to wait around until a 20% IRR comes, because, you know, maybe that's not what the market's offering. It might just be a mistake. So by having that real deal data, we're able to actually say, oh, okay, well, the top 5 percentile of deals exhibit these traits, or top 1 percentile. And then we know what to chase, and we know what's appropriate. And you know, so that's the second big point. And then the third big point I would say is risk. You know, risk is super, super important. And the greatest source of risk is debt. So it's being judicious with how we finance and making sure that if we're taking out a bridge loan, that the business plan and the returns justify it. You know, if we are, you know, if our plan is to sell in 5 years, maybe we shouldn't have yield maintenance debt, right? Because that prepayment penalty could come back to bite us, and all sorts of stuff. So I would say those are the three big things.
Right, man. That's fantastic. Yeah, I look forward to seeing where you guys go. Obviously, you've developed a really killer system there, and I was, you know, personal fan, and love following what you're doing on LinkedIn and the stuff you share out there. So that's super cool. Let's jump here into the final four. First question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
To an aspiring investor, whether it's a passive investor or an active investor, I would really develop, kind of going back to that trade tracker analysis that I discussed, developing that understanding of, you know, what is market, what is feasible and appropriate. And, you know, because if you're investing without comps per se, right, we're always doing comps, whether it's rent comps or sales comps, we should have investment comps. It would be in your best interest to look at more deals. The more deals you look at, whether as a passive or active investor, just informs you and provides more data.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. Question number two, when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
To stay on top of my game, I'm always looking for new literature to read. So something that myself and my director of acquisitions recently did is we, Houston's our target market and it's our main market of focus. So we downloaded every single submarket report from CoStar for Houston. And it was 30 reports and we read every single report just to kind of teach us more and refresh us and give us an understanding of where it is. And we'll probably reread because obviously things change. So when we pull that same 30 reports in 6 months or a year, CoStar will have different things to say and the data will be different. So doing that and reading similar literature is really beneficial.
Right. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Well, I really like to teach. I think you see that in my content and whatnot. And I'm always happy to share and, help grow with people.
Right. No, that's absolutely, absolutely true. Yeah. Plenty of that. So that's very cool. Rob, if listeners want to get in touch with you and also to get to your underwriting model, I know you'd mentioned that earlier on that you have a free underwriting model. How do they do that?
Yeah. The best way to learn more about us and of course, get the free underwriting model download is on our website, lscre.com. That stands for Lone Star Capital Real Estate. So lscre.com. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can email me rob@lonestarcapgroup.com.
Rob, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.